Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. In the summer of 2009, as she was covering the uprisings in Tehran for the New York Times, Iranian journalist Nazila Fati received a phone call. "They have given your photo to snipers," a government source warned her. Soon after, with undercover agents closing in, she fled the country with her husband and two children, beginning a life of exile. In her new book, The Lonely War, she interweaves her story with that of a country she left behind, showing how Iran is locked in a battle between hardliners and reformers that dates back to the country's 1979 revolution. Fati was 9 years old when that uprising replaced the Iranian Shah with a radical Islamic regime. Women Against War has brought Nazila Fati to the roundtable, to the area to speak about Iran and about growing up in Iran and pursuing a career as a journalist reporting from Tehran. She'll speak at Siena College from 4:30 to 6 o'clock tonight, 4:30 to 6 at Siena College, and we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe, for having me.
It's really an honor to have you on the program. I was telling you just before we went on, I read the book when it first came out, and we were hoping to have you on, and then we found out you were going to be in the region, and we said, okay, well, we'll wait to have you here in person because that's even better. And so we're thrilled that you were coming in, and I just have to say that it's such an amazing, frightful story, and yet you seem to have processed it so well. Does that come with sort of living the way you did for so many years, of really never knowing what's around the bend?
I'm not sure, Joe. I think I had to process the story for myself. That's why it took me a while to write it.
Yeah.
I didn't write it until about 3 years after I had left the country. And the book is part of the struggle that I had with myself to process and figure out what had happened to this country since 1979.
So, before we get into the meat of this, let's just get the elephant out of the room, which is what's going on now. And we're talking about deal, and Iran is very much in the news and very much in our foreign policy news. What do you think, as a longtime journalist on these issues, what do you think make of our current situation? A lot of back and forth over the weekend, of course, Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks earlier last week, putting a lot of fire to this as well. And we look at something where there have been negotiations for almost a year, and yet here we are still with, as the president said yesterday, big gaps.
Exactly. The negotiations have been going on for over a year, and I think there is a lot of hope that there would be a deal. And in the meantime, as you mentioned, there are a lot of efforts by people who want to kill a deal. So far, it seems that a deal might be coming out of these talks by the end of March. And I do hope that it does, because I am in favor of diplomacy. A lot of people inside Iran, a lot of people here in the United States favor an end to the standoff. And those who are opposed to a deal, I don't think they are seeing the long-term consequences of not having a deal with Iran over its nuclear program. On the contrary, if the standoff ends, the West would be empowering the moderates in Iran. And by empowering the moderates, these people would be in a better position to craft policies that would be more responsive to international demands. And I think that's the long-term consequence of having a deal.
In speaking yesterday, President Obama said that the United States has offered Iran, quote, an extraordinarily reasonable deal. Do you see it as extraordinarily reasonable?
I think it's a very good deal for Iran. I think it's also a good deal for the West, because it will finally put an end to this standoff. Under this deal, Iran's nuclear program would be curbed, and the West can make sure that Iran is not making a bomb. In the meantime, there will be time to negotiate with Iran about its role in the Middle East, considering what's happening in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen. And this would be a very strategic solution to all the problems that have been going on for the past, over the past 10 years, over Iran's nuclear program.
Do you find that the tenor of the place is one that would embrace peace?
You mean the Islamic Republic?
I was meaning your home country of Iran.
Well, you know, I must say my home country of Iran is a very divided place. It's a place that is divided between hardliners who have been pursuing quite irresponsible policies and moderate politicians who have been trying to be more pragmatic about the future of the country. In the past 35, 36 years since the revolution, the country has been torn between these two groups. And as time has passed, the moderates have become stronger in a sense that they've had more support. Their popular support base has expanded inside the country because the younger people, they want to have more moderate policies in the country. In the meantime, the hardliners have felt threatened, and they have reacted quite violently toward any kind of reform in the country. So I think if the West, if the outside world engages with the moderates, in that way, it will help them to have the upper hand in Iranian politics. If there is no deal, this would be a perfect opportunity for conservatives to continue with their propaganda, saying that it is not possible to have any kind of interaction with the West, with the outside world, and continue with their irresponsible, quite fundamentalist ideas.
Nazila Fateh is the author of the book, The Lonely War. She'll be speaking at Siena College tonight from 4:30 to 6, and you can find out more by going to siena.edu. The book, The Lonely War, tells of your account of fleeing the country, as I mentioned in the introduction, with your family. You thought it was just going to be a matter of days.
Yes. Yeah. When we left with a bag, packed a few T-shirts. We thought we would be back. There had been other times, turbulent times in Iran, but things have gone back to sort of a crazy normal again. I'd gone back. Things were fine again.
And what is it about what was it that made those days into weeks into years, in the sense of saying there is a point where you say, okay, this, we can't go back?
Well, you know, I think it shows that 2009, after the events of that followed the presidential election, were really huge, were probably the biggest historical events in contemporary history of Iran since the 1979 revolution. I still travel to other parts of the country or outside the U.S., meet with other Iranians, different conferences, and I come across a lot of other colleagues, Iranians who worked for local news organizations, who also fled in 2009. I don't know how large the number of people who fled in 2009 is, but it's definitely huge. And it says a lot about what happened that year. It was definitely a takeover by the Revolutionary Guards. On the ground, people were referring to the election as a coup d'etat. And in fact, it was. They made a big move to get rid of reformist politicians. Many of them are still in jail. They arrested a lot of activists on the ground. And a lot of people fled the country because they knew if they stayed, they would get into trouble. And I think I was one of those people. At the time, I thought, after a few months, when the protests would end, they would release people and everything would go back to normal. But they didn't release a lot of leading activists, a lot of leading politicians. They went ahead and arrested more people, including the two presidential candidates who are still in prison. And they are still very much alarmed by any kind of protests in the country. So I think 2009 was really, in a sense, a coup d'etat by the Revolutionary Guards.
You Your background is fascinating because you originally started as a translator, and then you met Judith Miller and got bitten by the journalism bug.
Yeah, I was very lucky to start working as a translator for Western media. That was how I managed to later become a journalist. And I started out as a translator. It was during an earthquake, one of the worst earthquakes that had hit Iran in decades. Thousands of people were killed, and Iran needed international aid. So it allowed a lot of foreign reporters to come to the country to report the scale of devastation. But of course, a lot of these people had come after many, many years into the country, and they were more interested in a life under the Islamic Republic than the damage by the earthquake. And I had a French teacher who was French, and a lot of Western reporters asked for her help to find people who could help them with translation, and she put me in touch with a big group of reporters. And just about a year later, I met Judith Miller of the New York Times.
And at this point, you, around 2009, when all this that you mentioned a moment ago, all of this is going on, you start translating, you start working, and then ultimately you're reporting on what is happening.
Yeah, it took a while. The best thing that happened and made becoming a journalist possible for me was the internet and email. When
right.
I got my first email service, and I was able to start filing stories and memos to reporters I had worked with. And it was at that stage that Time Magazine and the New York Times offered to put me on a retainer, and I actually started working as a reporter. But the Iranians were not giving me credentials. It took me a long time, until 1999, to get official credentials to work as a correspondent.
How much of what you went through and your struggle in having to leave do you think had to do with you being a journalist?
I think a lot. I think the Iranian regime was totally embarrassed about what we were writing in the media, Western media, about the protests on the ground and the violence that the regime was using to end the protests. Just about a day after the election, the government sent out a fax to all reporters on the ground and ordered us not to cover it. The Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, which was in charge of reporters, asked us not to leave our offices, and the letter said that if we went out, anything happened to us, the government was not responsible for our safety. And that was part of the government's effort to stop us from covering the demonstrations. They thought they could end it, and they thought that they could do it silently. Unfortunately, they had already invited a lot of reporters, even like the Bill Keller of the New York Times. The executive editor of the New York Times was in Iran. There were many, many other reporters from big news organizations who were already on the ground, and they were covering the protests. And the regime was very embarrassed about the international coverage of the events, and that was part of their effort to silence it.
And what's fascinating is you go back to, you're about to enter the third grade, your mother sits you down and says, look, if anyone asks you whether your parents support the revolution, say yes. Mm-hmm. And you make the point very early in the book that difference in public and private personas was very important. So here you are, even as a journalist, saying, okay, well, I know what the truth is, but I'm being told not to tell it. And that must be, that dual persona must be extremely difficult, as you said a moment ago, of your homeland being so divided.
Yeah. But, you know, as you said, it is hard to sort of maneuver between those two worlds, the public life and the private life,
right.
The private life where you are very honest, you know the truth, and the public life where, again, you know what the truth is, but you have to pretend. But I think what has happened over the past 35 years in Iran is that line is getting blurred. In a sense, I mean, you still have to pretend in public. But once you start talking to people, even people who are with the regime, there is some kind of honesty. During the 2009 election, there were a lot of people who were coming out, and they belonged to that side that was supposed to support the government. Many of the children of the Revolutionary Guards were coming out. Officials' children were coming out. And when they were arrested, they were reported in news media. And everybody was aware of it. So that line began shifting. And that didn't change the fact that I was very eager to tell what was happening on the ground. I was there as a reporter, and it was my job to tell what was happening. And in fact, it was the biggest story. This was the story that I had waited for all those years that I had worked as a journalist. So I wanted to tell what was going on, despite what the government had requested from us.
We were shocked by what was happening. I mean, you have that knowledge, you know the truth. So was there anything that was really truly shocking to you?
Yes. It was quite shocking to see such numbers of people pour out. Yeah. It was very spontaneous. I wasn't expecting it. I don't think anyone else was expecting it. But it showed something. It showed that the deep level of anger and frustration among people at the regime.
I have about a million more questions for you. So my question to you first is, do you have about 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and then we'll continue our conversation. We're talking to Nazlia Fateh. Yes. The name of the book is The Lonely War. She's going to be speaking about Iran tonight at Siena College. The Women Against War have brought her here, and we are thrilled to have her as our guest. Siena.edu for more information. We'll continue our conversation after the short break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning with Nazlia Fateh, who is the author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She will be speaking tonight at Siena College from 4:30 to 6, and you can find out more information by going to siena.edu. What will you be talking to the students about tonight?
I will telling them why I wrote The Lonely War. When I came here, people asked me a lot of questions about Iran, and I realized that, first of all, there were many cliches and misperceptions about Iran. And then secondly, Iran had been so isolated since the 1979 revolution that people didn't know how this country and society had evolved. So I'm going to tell some stories about how Iran has evolved during these years that it has been quite isolated.
This, because of that isolation, this becomes very obvious when you read the book. But talk about just that title of The Lonely War, of the loneliness of that.
Yeah. Well, it refers to many wars, many battles. I mean, we can start with the war with Iraq, which was quite a devastating war. And even though many Iranians, especially middle and upper class families, didn't want the war to drag on for such a long time, and it did. But Iran had to fight that war quite by itself. Iran was isolated by many Western countries. In the Middle East, most Arab and Sunni countries supported Saddam. They were providing Saddam with weapons. Iran had to practically rely on its army, on its men, to fight the war. And in the meantime, it was a war that Khomeini wanted to drag on to stabilize the foundation of the regime. And it wasn't something that the majority of Iranians wanted to see drag on. But in the meantime, there were so many other battles that we had to wage: the battle of Iranian women against oppression, the battle of trying to define ourselves as girls growing up under the Islamic Republic, and just trying to keep some space for ourselves. And there were many people who were activists, people who wanted to do things that the Islamic Republic didn't allow them to do.
Is that, I guess you could ask this of any journalist, but and people do ask it of any journalist, but I am curious in your very specific circumstance of, is it difficult to not be an activist in some way, given what you've experienced, given the hardships, given that colleagues of yours are behind bars?
Well, it depends on how you define activism. I mean, a lot of Iranians became journalists because journalism was a way for them to express themselves and write about their opinions. So that was a kind of activism. As I was growing up in Iran, all my effort was to be somebody else, not to be the person that my school my school principal wanted us to be. And it wasn't just me. It was everybody around me. I mean, I don't know anyone in my class who didn't try to be herself, not to accept the hegemony that the Islamic Republic wanted to impose on us. But I never saw that as activism. I saw that as being a free person, somebody independent. Activism was more to me what, when we grew up, a lot of people in their 20s and their 30s started doing to change the status quo.
Yeah.
I was never part of that. And I knew a lot of people who were not part of that. But in the meantime, the big majority of Iranians were not happy with the situation. And we always did things differently. So if you want to call that activism as well, it could be called activism because there you have a huge population of women, half of the population, who have managed to push back the boundaries that the Islamic Republic imposed on them in 1979.
Is anger ever a proper word for you to use for what you've been through? Or toward what you've been through?
I think anger is a very proper word to use for all Iranians who grew up in the Islamic Republic. Anger and frustration, because the Islamic Republic has thrived on intimidating its people from day one. From the day that Khomeini returned to Iran, started rounding up whoever opposed his regime and executed them. At schools, they sent in teachers, they call them morality teachers, and they were responsible to, first of all, indoctrinate us, and if they couldn't do that, they intimidated us. From day one, the regime founded these militia forces called the morality police to patrol the streets and pick up people who were not dressed according to what the regime had defined. All those policies have created a huge amount of anger and frustration in Iranian society, both men and women and people of any age.
I mentioned this in the introduction, but if you're just joining us, at the time where you're given a phone call and say they've given your photo to snipers and you flee the country with your husband and two children. We've talked about that story, but I'm curious as to would you have left if it was just you?
I don't know. I was when I was on the plane, and the plane was taking off. I was crying, and I was torn between two very strong feelings of wanting to protect my children,
sure,
and but also feeling betraying people who had helped me cover Iran for the past almost two decades. Almost everyone I had interviewed, almost all my sources at that point had been jailed, a couple of my colleagues. And at that time, I didn't know what was happening to them in prison. I thought there were all these people who were just sitting there. I had no idea that they were being tortured, beaten up. But I mean, going to prison at that stage was not a personal concern to me. I was not afraid. I was more concerned with protecting my children from seeing me taken away, dragged away in front of them. And that was what they had done to many others. They had just barged into their homes and taken them away in front of their children. So if I was not a mother, I might have stayed. I might have chosen to stay and report the story because it was a big story and I wanted to report it.
When you got the phone call, you knew who was calling, obviously.
Yeah.
And is it a point where, okay, well, you know why they're calling, you know, they're putting the force on you and saying, okay, now's the time where you have to make your decision. So is it, I mean, in that way, I guess it's lucky because you have the heads up, but then still, you still have to make the decision. But I guess what I'm asking is you always knew that was a possibility.
Yeah, I knew that was a possibility. Actually, I knew that possibility since the day I started working.
Right.
And throughout the years, this had happened to many, many of my friends and colleagues. They had been forced to leave the country unexpectedly. I knew it might happen to me. I had spoken to my editors about it many times. But I didn't expect it to be in 2009 after the elections. And when I got that phone call, I thought the commander who was calling me was just trying to intimidate me because
right.
That was after the letter I had received from the government and the protests were just getting more intensified and I was going out. I didn't believe him. I didn't take him seriously. I didn't tell anyone about the phone call. It was just a few days after that when my house came under surveillance. I was leaving my apartment building and I noticed that there were about 16 men outside our home and they started following me in their car and there were men on motorcycles. It was then that I realized how serious that threat had been. I went back home. I just drove around the block and I didn't leave the house anymore until 3 days later when we left the country.
As we noted before, when you left the country, you thought it would just be temporary. And what I find fascinating in reading the book is that at no time do you paint an optimistic picture that anything would be different now, right? I mean, nothing really has changed for journalists covering this story, meaning what is happening within the walls of power in Iran.
No, unfortunately, no. Human rights situation has not improved in Iran, even with the election of President Rouhani, who is a more moderate figure. Despite the more positive developments on the nuclear front, human rights situation in Iran has deteriorated. The number of people who are still in prison, the number of executions has soared. That hasn't changed at all. That's why I'm optimistic if the pressure on Iran's nuclear program is lifted, if the pressure on Iran's economy is lifted, civil society will get a chance to breathe and things might start changing then. Otherwise, the government has tried to tighten the leash on society. People are still in prison. Prominent politicians are all behind bars because clearly hardliners are afraid to let them get out and be in touch with their supporters.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll finish up our conversation. Nasila Fateh is our author is our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. And she'll be speaking at Siena College tonight from 4:30 to 6, sponsored by Women Against War. Siena.edu for more information, and we'll be right back after this short break. I feel bad that you fled Iran, and now I'm holding you hostage.
Oh, you can hold me hostage here. I prefer to be here.
We are talking to Nasila Fateh, who is the author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. The book came out in December, and it's really an amazing account. And I want to focus in on those words, the struggle for modern Iran, because just as we were leaving the last segment, we were talking about optimism and where your optimism lies in that. So modern Iran doesn't necessarily have to be a good thing, right? I mean, that's just what is current. So what do you think the struggle, what are we struggling for and what is the ultimate hope of what can be achieved?
Well, Joe, as you mentioned before the break, this regime remains to be very oppressive.
Yeah.
The kind of change that has to come from top to bottom is not coming. But in the meantime, Iranian society has taken the best, has tried to make the best in the past 35 years. It has taken advantage of all opportunities to move forward. And if we just start with education levels, I mean, in the past 35 years, Iranian society has become increasingly more educated. Illiteracy is almost non-existent among people under the age of 24. Women have become very educated. Education levels are almost similar to here in the United States. More than half of university students were women since 2000. At some universities, 70% of students were women in 2014, and this is just really, really high. If you want to change a society, you have to change their women, because they raise the next generation. And if women change in a society, you know that they don't go toward fundamentalist ideas, that they are the ones who would encourage moderation. So Iran has changed in very, very profound ways over the past 35 years. Before the revolution, the big majority of people lived in the villages. Now over 70% live in urban areas, in cities. A big majority, more than 70%, are middle class. The oil money has been distributed among people, whether it's been in form of handouts or subsidies for energy and many other things that the government pays out. The money has been distributed among the population. Even a good 40% of people who live in villages are considered middle class. And the kind of change that you want to see in society has already occurred in Iran. So the grassroots change has taken place. Iranian society is prepared to accept the kind of top-down changes that the government can implement. Unfortunately, the government is too repressive to give in to positive change. But I think that shows that the future is going to be definitely different, because Iranian leaders are quite old. Their children don't support their ideas. Many of them took part in the demonstrations of 2009. Change is going to come to Iran.
So two points on what you just said. One is, and I'll ask them both at the same time, and then you can answer them however you wish. One is that because of that oppression, and with all that you have mentioned, especially, and I gravitate to your points about women and the education and the great and the numbers, which are very encouraging and incredible. So there has to be a breaking point, right? I mean, there has to be a point where that becomes so overwhelming that it breaks the oppression, it would seem to me. But also into this is the rest of the world, which is also, it seems like everybody has to get their act together, right? I mean, it's all this house of cards with all of your neighboring countries around you and the turmoil and hot spots that they have become as well.
That is very true. But I think they have also been a lesson for Iranians. After the 1979 revolution, we had quite a bloody confrontation. Khomeini went after his opponents, killed hundreds of people. Then we had 8 years of war. And these realities have shaped Iranian people. A lot of people don't want to see any kind of institutional breakdown because they think the same thing that happened after the revolution might happen again. And then after 2009, we had the case of Egypt, the case of Syria, and of course the instability in Iraq that has been dragging on. And I think Iranians have learned from all those examples. And one reason they withdrew from the streets in 2009, and a lot of people were talking about it and writing about it, was that if there is any kind of insecurity, like the ones that happened in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, hardliners can hijack the situation again. So they prefer to move slowly but steadily.
Mm. The slowly part, though, I mean, for you, you've been dealing this with this all your life, and seeing, I mean, not to be blasé about it, but to see revolutions come and go, and as a young person, that is, you know, to see that much turmoil in a rather short period of time is, I want to go back to a word that you used earlier, which is anger, but also great frustration. You must be incredibly frustrated.
Yeah. As you said, the pace of change being slow makes you even more frustrated. But there's also fear. I mean, the fear of a civil war that just broke out in Iraq has been going on. In Syria, in almost Libya. I mean, these are all things that have been happening at the same time when Iranians were going through their own upheaval. And when you look at Iran in the past some 20 years since the war ended in 1988, when the economy started moving forward, people started making lives for themselves, people remember those days. They don't want to go back to that insecurity and instability. You know, in 2009, when I was going out to cover the protests, I had a hard time finding a driver who was willing to drive me to downtown Tehran. Mm. The drivers, most of them came from poorer neighborhoods, but they said that they didn't want to drive into areas where there were protests because they were afraid that a rock would get hurled at their car and the car would get damaged. So, I mean, imagine if people are not willing to get a scratch on their cars, are they willing to go through more instability? Are they willing to put themselves at any kind of risk or danger? I think what happened in the region intensified those fears. And so they prefer to live under some kind of security and stability than risk that for having more political freedom. I mean, if political freedom doesn't have any meaning, if you don't have security, if you don't have economic security.
Right.
At this point, Iranians have economic security and personal security.
Do you feel that, having worked for the New York Times, having been a reporter from Tehran, do you feel that this is sort of a double-edged sort of a question, but do you feel that we as consumers of news in this country are getting the story? Is the story getting out properly from reputable news sources as to what is happening, number one? And number two, to a larger question from the perspective of an Iranian who is here in this country, of are we consuming it in a proper way of being as maybe shocked or horrified as we should be?
Well, I think, Joe, the story is coming out. There are many, many good reporters who are telling the story. But it's not just the story of Iran. It's the story of many, many other countries.
Sure.
And not just in the Middle East, around the world. I don't expect American consumers to know all these countries well or to get the stories exactly the way they are. And in the meantime, Iran has been isolated. Sometimes you see a movie comes out about Iran, and that movie, what was it called? The Separation, for instance.
Yes.
A lot of people watched, and then they got a better sense of about Iran than any of the new stories that people have been writing about or even I wrote about. So it is hard. It is hard to give the right sense about a country that has been isolated and demonized for such a long time.
What is next for you?
I don't know. That's the $1 million question.
There aren't journalistic institutions knocking at your door saying, we need you to report for us.
I hope there will be.
Well, the book is magnificent. It is called The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. And it is it's so striking and so well written. It's really beautifully written.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. A reminder that Nazila Fathi will be speaking at Siena College tonight. She's going to be talking about Iran and about growing up in Iran and pursuing a career as a journalist and reporting from Tehran, as well as about the book, The Lonely War. You can find out more information by going to siena.edu. The event is sponsored by Women Against War, and they'll be on hand tonight as well. The event is from 4:30 to 6 at Siena College, and again, you can find out information by going to siena.edu. The name of the book is The Lonely War. It's published by Basic Books. Nazila Fateh, I thank you so much for being with us, for spending so much time, and for being so gracious. I appreciate it, and for the wonderful work you've done.
Thank you, Joe. It was my pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you.